Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Fatma Sayed, and this is The Backbench, a podcast about Canadian politics. For our first episode of 2022, wow, it's so strange to say that, we're going to do things a little bit differently because Parliament is not back in session yet. They're back January 31st. So this week, we're having an extended conversation that really digs into what me and producer Tiffany Lam thought was the biggest story of last year. The discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves of Indigenous children at former residential school grounds across the country. Now, there hasn't been too much movement from Ottawa on how to account for this colonial legacy, but two major things have happened since. Most recently, in December, the CBC reported that Ottawa released early details of a $40 billion settlement for Indigenous people impacted by the state child welfare system. This is a non-binding agreement, and parties have until the end of March to sign off on it. It sets aside $20 billion for compensation and $20 billion for long-term reform of the on-reserve child welfare system. All eyes are now on the federal government to reveal how exactly they will change this. And then, back in August, Ottawa announced its intention to fill a new interlocutor position to help guide the process of what we do with the unmarked graves moving forward. Do we keep searching and excavating? What will we do with what we'll find? And what does it mean to protect the graves? Today we'll get into what this interlocutor position can do, what else Ottawa has done or not done to right their wrongs so far, and how Indigenous people here on this land are processing all of this. If 2021 was the reckoning, then 2022 has to be about following through. And that's why we're starting the new year with this conversation. Before we start dissecting all of this, a warning. This episode contains some distressing details about death and violence within residential schools. For this conversation, I'm joined by Lena Manithi, producer and co-founder of Ricochet Media.
Hi, good morning, Fatma.
Riley Yesno, writer and researcher at the Yellowhead Institute.
Hi, good morning.
And Romeo Saganash, former actual backbencher member of Parliament.
Hi, good to see you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Lena, you've spent the past year having conversations about what happened. Tell us what you've learned and what you've been thinking about.
Well, this recent discovery of the mass graves. We can start from there, that it's not a recent discovery. It's been, you know, outlined in Volume 4 of the TRC. It has been talked about for a while. And as I said before, there's actually discoveries that predate this in 2015 and 16 as well. We're using the technology and the GPR that they've done right now. So it's a conversation we're revisiting for 2021 here, and it is one that we needed to have a long time ago. I've probably been in the presence and around people telling their stories, probably over 50 different residential school survivors, maybe up to 60. And they all stick with you. Each person is very individual with their experience and with the stories they've shared. But I'd say the closest one to heart is hearing from an elder about their experiences, you know, witnessing death and finding bodies as a child and being denied that they didn't see what they saw and being punished for it. These are some of the really hard stories we have to kind of get into and that people don't know about.
Yeah, Romeo, what has stuck with you over the past year as, you know, the conversation has sort of restarted, but on some broader scale?
Well, needless to say, how triggering it was for me, given my personal story with my own siblings. 13 of the 14 siblings attended residential school. Unfortunately, the first one had left in 1954, before even I was even born, died the first year at age of 5. And we never knew where what had happened and so on. So it was triggering in that sense. But you used the expression, the biggest story of 2021. I would say from our perspective, it was a long-standing story. Mm-hmm. It's the longest story for us, as a matter of fact. So however difficult it was, we knew of this situation for a long time. A lot of witnesses to the TRC told us stories, their own personal stories, including myself, and how we, by accident, found my little brother after 40 years of not knowing where he was, where he was buried, what happened. As you know, there's no other death certificates for these kids. That type of stuff came up again for many of us survivors, and especially my family. So mm-hmm. It was a rather difficult summer for all of us, the surviving survivors to this day in my family. But unfortunately, even with all the promises and words that have been expressed by the federal government and Prime Minister Trudeau in particular, there was a $13 million earmarked, for instance, to help communities. And again, recently, Trudeau re-promised again in early December to the chiefs and assembly of the AFN that there would be a special interlocutor that will be appointed. Trudeau said that we will ensure that the communities undertaking burial searches have what they need. Mm. Well, if we're going to provide communities with what they need to do these searches, and this technology is very expensive, the $13 million that was earmarked to do this, it's just a mere drop in the bucket, in my view, that we have to increase that money in order for those communities to have closure and to heal.
I mean, we have three generations of Indigenous guests on the show today. And Riley, you're the youngest. What stood out to you over this year? Like, were you surprised by anything? You know, what are you thinking as you look ahead to how we go about, you know, identifying these graves and doing the work of reconciliation that really needs to be done?
I should preface, I guess, and say I was born in 1999. So I am of the only generation in this country that has certifiably never been to a residential school. And it's wild for me to think about, like, that, how young I am on this panel in every space and, you know, what that means. My grandparents attended Shingwak Residential School, and like, they have never been able to talk about it with me at all, or anyone, as far as I know. The same thing with all of their siblings. It's stories you know through being in community, but like, when the news was coming out and folks were talking about this consistently, right? Like, there's like such a profound amount of grief. These are stories that like are so horrible, so whatever, and the ways that they affected my grandparents in ways that they, you know, they can't even speak about it. And I saw my aunts and my uncles talking, they posted on Facebook and they were like, I'm so glad everybody's talking about this. Like, I am a survivor. And it was the first time I had ever heard from any of them in their own words, like even acknowledging the fact that they attended a residential school. So like, interpersonally, it was extremely like profound and heavy, and is still something that like, I feel like we're all reeling from. And then, you know, with that in mind, which is like a full-time, you know, job to really work through and to sit with, there was also just having to observe the way Canada dealt with that news. And the way that it quickly became like this really politicized bargaining chip for like a lot of parties, a virtue signaling thing for a lot of folks. And it's especially frustrating because when we're talking about when should we stop wearing our orange shirts and when do the flags go down is like what the conversation became. Meanwhile, I'm living in Thunder Bay, Ontario, where there is an active continuation of the residential school. Like, never mind the child welfare system, which we often talk about as being a continuation of the residential school. Like, kids actively being forced to leave their communities to come to Thunder Bay, where they die at the hands of white folks and within, like, the Canadian institutions to get an education. So, like, none of that, though, being talked about how Canada could address some of these ongoing legacies. It, like, was so frustrating and continues to be very frustrating to watch how people think we should grapple with this.
Lena, were you surprised by just the sheer amount of conversation that this started and just the way it was unfolding?
I was actually quite surprised because this same conversation didn't hit when the TRC came out. Prior to that, I've been working at news organizations and had always had the conversation in newsrooms that this wasn't genocide. There's no proof. There's no bodies. You can't report that these things are true and factual. You can't talk about them being survivors because there's no proof of death. So just having to deal with that in my young journalism years is always, it was always sort of brushed to the side as this sort of myth, you know. And so it's an awakening of the public in the public sphere. But I think the TRC sort of primed people to kind of for this conversation. I just don't think it had actually hit them or people had actually dug into what the TRC had said. And so it's this slow reveal. And I guess people really finally were at home during COVID, during lockdown, reading, listening to news in a way I think that they're engaging in a deeper way and sort of it sinking in. I mean, I was looking at polls about people not being shocked, and I was actually surprised to see that there are people who are quite familiar with the story, you know, and a lot of people knew a little bit about residential school, but the amount of people who didn't know anything had gone down to like 20% of the population, which I think that's the most people knowing about residential school and what has happened there than has been prior.
I think, at least for my part, if the Canadian public didn't bother reading at least a summary of the TRC report, obviously they didn't know about that. My thoughts were with the families and communities that lost children, that had children never to return home, and especially in this so-called era of reconciliation in this country. We're supposed to know these things by now. But I thought about the communities as well, because I know for a fact that many communities will choose different paths in this early healing journey. And there are different examples across the country how different communities dealt with former residential school structures. You know, I can point to an example in BC, the St. Eugene Mission Residential School near Cranbrook. They turned that residential school into a hotel resort that I visited. And other communities will choose another path to close that chapter, terrible chapter in their lives. For instance, when we finally found my little brother, Johnny's, 40 years after he had disappeared, we finally found him, the body. And in her dying days, just about 3 years ago now, I asked my mom if she wished we repatriate the remains of Johnny's to his traditional territory in northern Quebec. And she said to me at that moment, she said, no, don't bother, because I'll see him again anyway. You know, so different people will choose the way they want to deal with this. Different communities will choose different paths. And my mind and thoughts were with these people all along. And the solutions being proposed right now with this special interlocutor is one avenue. We've yet to see the mandate of this and the terms of reference of this special interlocutor. While the AFN national chief had asked for an arm's length independent UN investigation into this, which is probably the most reasonable thing to do as well in my mind. But here we are in this era of reconciliation. We have a federal government that is still fighting Indigenous children in court, that is still fighting residential school survivors, in particular St. Anne's, in court, that are still hiding residential school records or failing to give them over to the Truth and Reconciliation Center. So I'm not sure if all of this is conducive of reconciliation, frankly.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the interlocutor, right? Lena, you've spoken to a lot of people in the last several months for your documentary. I'm curious to hear what you're hearing about what people want.
I would like to get back to the interlocutor versus rapporteur eventually at some point with Romeo. But what we're hearing is that the people don't want the same things, especially when I was in the community of Tecumloops. There are people who are deeply spiritual and deeply religious and don't think that there should be digging up the graves and sort of doing the DNA testing, and they kind of want to leave them be. And then there are people who definitely want to go towards the criminal charges and would like to know if it's their family and are willing to go forward and have their DNA tested. So there's sort of a argument against excavation and for excavation. And I think these communities are still grappling heavily with what it means to them in a spiritual sense and an investigative sense. So there's not one true answer that everybody holds here.
Mm-hmm. Acknowledging that my expertise is virtually zero around the actual best practices that have been used for situations like this, like mass graves and excavations, we have to talk about what are we going to do about these graves, certainly, but we can't do just that and then not address the just swath of inequities that are just baked into every single part of this country, right? I think it's also important that we use this as a moment to really reflect on how much work there is to do and how much better people have to be about this. So the things I've been doing right now, my research right now is looking at just the original TRC document at the beginning and doing a textual analysis of the way that survivors articulated their visions of reconciliation and then the way that Canada responded to that, where the commission used firm words, phrases like atonement, action, political will, substantial investment. The Canadian government used words and phrases with much more abstract connotations, such as acknowledge, promote awareness, support commemoration. Perhaps most compellingly, right, where the TRC produced calls to action, the government requested recommendations. There was never supposed to be anything, binding, and the will behind it that it required from the onset. And I think we're still struggling to get to that place. And so how do I make Canada have the will to address, it's just fundamental inequities? I'm still unsure about that. But I do think that that definitely comes from our communities ourselves. The reason why this was the biggest story of the year and, of, I think, the decade, and why we're talking about it right now, is not because, Justin Trudeau made it so. It's because our communities for generations, would not let these stories die and would not let the public, forget about them. And so I think that has to be then the only way forward.
I mean, Lena, in conversations, you've described this issue not as a political one, but as a criminality issue.
Yeah. In most cases and areas, people really want to get down to the reasons why the children have died. I mean, a lot of people have been, there's a substantial amount of people who point to the TRC and say, well, a lot of these kids were, exposed to tuberculosis and had disease and were in overcrowding situations. But a lot of those determinants of why they died is actually solely rests on the Catholic Church as well as the federal government, like both of them colluded together to have residential schools happen and for people to pass away. So whether it was through the malnutrition, which was forced upon the children, which people would, parents would go to jail indefinitely if their kids were died from malnutrition, there's people not being sort of held accountable in this way. So they need to find out, a lot of people want to find out why and how the children died. Of course, there's many first eyewitness testimony to children dying under the TRC. But, you know, the community I was working with wants to pursue criminal charges and wants people to be held account. Those who are living right now who are responsible for those children's deaths should be held accountable. And it's something that we've, you know, avoided talking about. And the government keeps avoiding talking about this.
I totally concur with what has just been said, having witnessed a lot of this stuff in my 10 years in residential school. Yes, this first and foremost should be criminal investigations, because that's what happened. I still recall how, I won't name the kid, how he was thrown from the third floor and totally crushed upon landing. I don't know if you ever heard what it sounds like when a person falls first on its head directly. It's a terrible sound that I can still hear today. So yeah, that would be my preferred route as a person from with a legal background. But I've watched this government since 2015. I was reelected in 2015. And in the beautiful words and promises that Justin Trudeau made in December 2015. As a matter of fact, one of his first speeches to the AFN was in December of 15, shortly after his election in October. One of the things he promised back then was that the federal government would rescind all of the laws that were unilaterally imposed on Indigenous peoples by governments.
We will conduct a full review of the legislation unilaterally imposed on Indigenous peoples by the previous government. Where measures are found to be in conflict with your rights, where they are inconsistent with the principles of good governance, or where they simply make no public policy sense, we will rescind them. And I know just the Minister of Justice to keep an eye on that.
I clearly hear the words again, and I'm quoting them by heart here. I was sitting in the back room. I said, "Oh, great! Let's start with the Indian Act, then, you know, because it still remains troublesome to have such a legislation in a country called Canada in 2022." A lot of people tell me every time I meet people in the streets or in meetings, "Well, you know, Roman reconciliation takes time." Well, that's a misunderstanding and a misread of what the Supreme Court said in 2004 in the Haida Nation case. Supreme Court talked about reconciliation in 2004. And Supreme Court said two things about reconciliation. One, that reconciliation is a process and not an end in itself, which basically means that every action that you want to take legislatively, politically, or otherwise, you need to think about, is this conducive to reconciliation? Every single act that you make, whether you're municipal, provincial, or federal government, that's what the Supreme Court meant. The second thing the Supreme Court said in that same case in 2004 was that the objective is to reconcile the pre-existing sovereignty of Indigenous peoples with the assumed sovereignty of the Crown. Mm. It's quite a challenge. That's quite a challenge. And I think we have a long ways to go if people don't understand what reconciliation means in all of this, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in because I'm like everything you're saying is like sparking off things in my brain, right? People have said the same thing to me again and again, like reconciliation is something that takes so much time, like whatever, blah, blah, blah. And like, it's so funny when you see the Yellowhead Institute, for example. They did an analysis of, like, at this rate, completing the TRC calls to action, which, by the way, like, of course, like, if you read them, should just be baseline expectations, right? Like, they're not even anything like, you know, getting into this, like, huge conversation of reparations. Those are just, like, bringing us up to, like, a status of basic healing. They're not supposed to be finished at this rate until, like, 2073, when I'll be, like, 80 years old. You know, like, an entire generation, all our survivors will be gone. And so, like, I just don't have time for Canada's pace of this, you know, like, I think it's a huge excuse. It's not in line with what the survivors originally intended this, I think, process to look like. And then the other thing about it that Romeo is saying that is, like, really sticking with me is, like, yeah, the conversations about criminality and justice, and it's making me reflect on some of my time working with cases of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. I think a lot of the principles from the MMIWG report are also applicable in these cases, you know, like harsher sentencing when it comes to crimes perpetrated against Indigenous women. I think, like, that should also stand for, like, crimes that happen against Indigenous children, you know, just even no matter how many years pass. But the other thing that, you know, and I was heavily involved with a woman named Barbara Kentner's case. Her murderer did end up serving jail time. He was sentenced to a really high amount of time under a manslaughter conviction. And I just remember the feeling when, you know, he was sentenced and how hollow it still felt and how it was very hard to call anything that happened to Barbara and to her family justice. Even that he got a guilty verdict, like, there's no recourse for her family. There's no change to the system that made this a multi-year battle that put them through trauma day in, day out. There was no structural changes to Thunder Bay that, you know, addressed the racism that allowed her to be murdered in the first place. And so I think, again, to, like, an earlier point about how this is about these children and it's about residential schools and it's about these graves, but it's also about having, like, I think, a really confrontational conversation about, like, what do things like justice actually look like and what could it look like, as opposed to the necessary baselines of, like, yes, we should be pursuing criminal charges and to be more fulsome.
So, Lena, do we think this interlocutor role will maybe start addressing some of the structural nuances of the multiple issues at hand?
I think the interlocutor position is sort of almost replacing the UN Rapporteur. Canada kind of really wants to show that they're compliant and agreeing with the investigations right now, if they're criminal or not, to see where the graves are and how these children died, whether it was intentional, purposeful, or disease. They have their hands really tied, actually. So according to the Globe Mail article, they received some information. They're saying that basically the interlocutor is not allowed to interview anybody, not allowed to talk to potential witnesses or victims, not allowed to collect original documents at all or seize physical evidence, and all these powers that can kind of inform the criminal cases in the future. So it's really a bridge role that is sort of being there in order to sort of communicate to First Nations and the government about what's happening, and sort of it's a communications position in a lot of senses. So where the rapporteur would be somebody who would actually have to hold to account, report to the UN, and this is more of Romeo's expertise in working with rapporteurs in the past. But that would sort of bring up to an international level, and this interlocutor is very internal.
I guess, like, I always get stuck here because it seems like the roadmap is laid out and no one's willing to walk on it.
That's what I was thinking. because, you know, the solutions have been proposed through many commissions, committee reports, Royal Commission 96, TRC, now the National Inquiry. So if you combine all of these recommendations, call to action, call for justice, I mean, the roadmap is there. What's lacking and what continues to lack as we speak in 2022 is the political will to do so. So it's a choice. Governing is a choice. You either choose reconciliation or you choose the path that you've been following as a colonial government all along. The TRC, I think it's Call to Action 46, has called for a reset of our relations. The number one item on the agenda between peoples is their relations. And our relations with the governments in this country have not been working, and all these commissions and have called for change, and we're still not going in that direction. I think the only positive change, somewhat, that was made by this government since 2015 has been the adoption of C-15, the law on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. In fact, Bill C-15 only confirms something that already existed legally in the different legal frameworks that we have internationally and nationally in Indigenous law and so on, that the UN Declaration already had application in Canadian law since its adoption by the General Assembly in 2007. Bill C-15 merely confirms that it has application in Canadian law. In fact, the Supreme Court back in 1987 said, it was, I believe, the former Chief Justice Dixon who said that all these international instruments that we have, and he names them, declarations, covenants, conventions, international treaties, international decisions and quasi-judicial decisions, are all relevant and persuasive sources to interpret domestic law. And that's what should be happening all along.
One of the fascinating things to watch in 2021 surrounding the discoveries was just the way the public responded, right?
There's a lot of anecdotal stories I'm sure everybody on the panel can tell, where people have approached them or reached out to them and said, you know, things like, I'm sorry, or I had no clue, and we're sorry we didn't know. Especially when I was in the community hanging out with people from Tecumloops, there was a regular approach to people from Tecumloops, which is also really hard to see, like people approaching everywhere at any situation. But there's a desire to reach out and say, like, I didn't know, we didn't realize, or we're sorry for this happening as individuals in Canada, which I thought that was going to happen, you know, after the TRC or after the report finally on murder and missing women. And it was intense and it's overwhelming, but it's reassuring to me that most people, I'd say the majority, it's especially with the poll we're looking at, know about residential school and agree the policies were genocidal in intention. And yeah, it was just a huge shift to see Canada Day be taken over by people who are, you know, marching and out in allyship to go against Canada, not for this sort of nationalistic and superficial attachment to Canada. They decided to forego it in order to be allies and to walk out and be supportive of the communities. And that's never happened for me. So, and I don't think it's happened for, you know, a lot of those people who have survived. And, you know, now those who are deceased don't get to see that shift.
Riley, do you see it as a turning point?
I mean, I hope so. I think, like, that's a choice that Canadians still have to make. And I think that they have every motivation to. They should have, you know, the beginnings and entrances into this conversation to be able to make that choice. Like, I love what Lena was saying, because you made me reflect on my time on what is Canada Today. And I think about, you know, how many years ago it was just Canada 150 and how much, like, crap Indigenous people got across the country for protesting Canada 150. And now just these handful of years later that I too, you know, was like in on Canada Day with a whole bunch of folks, like, showing up wearing their orange and like not a like red and white flag in sight, and like what a transformative moment that felt like. The thing that I'm noticing, and I have a lot of conversations with my non-Indigenous friends about, is that I think like Canadians are right now going through a moment and like a reckoning and like dealing with profound grief that like Indigenous people have been working through for generations. They've been sold this house of lies, and how identity shaking that is for folks. And now the choice comes, like, what are we going to rebuild instead? And luckily for Canadians, Indigenous people have always been telling us what we want that to be. And through those reports, through, you know, our conversations, our visions for the future. Indigenous people always intended, you know, from my teachings, like to be able to live alongside non-Indigenous people. And we have like real protocols and actionable ways to make that happen. I just think that sometimes it's hard because colonialism, amongst its many terrible effects, really stunts the imagination, I think. I think that it makes it really hard for people to imagine a future that doesn't include domination and hierarchy and one government ahead of another, even though our people would know that that doesn't have to be so. And so I just hope that, you know, Canadians can pursue that path. And I think that they have every resource to be able to.
Romeo, last word to you.
Oh.
As are you surprised? as we're looking ahead, do you see real meaningful change coming in 2022 after everything that happened in 2021 and before, and all the things that the government seems to be saying that it's putting in place?
Well, that's a good question. And after the election in 2015 of this present government, I was a bit hopeful. I listened to that speech that Trudeau gave to the chiefs in assembly in December 2015. And I walked out of there and I said to myself, well, maybe there's a chance of change. But what I was seeing as this government went along was pretty exasperating. To the point I had to say a bad word in Parliament at one point.
They have decided to willfully violate their constitutional duties and obligations. Mr. Minister, Mr. Speaker, sounds like a most important relationship, doesn't it? Why doesn't the Prime Minister just say the truth and tell Indigenous peoples that he doesn't give a fuck about their rights?
I was so exasperated by seeing this talk and no action at all. But over the years, I can say this. I've been in this business for 40 years. I started working with Billy Diamond, late Billy Diamond, the first Grand Chief of the Grand Council of the Cree of Northern Quebec, 1981. And over the years, I've noticed how this clinging to the status quo is so fierce by all levels of government that change will only come slowly. And my biggest regret, I can say, after 40 years in this business, and I'm trying to walk away from it slowly, but people are holding on to me, including yourself, by the way.
But, I have no regrets.
But my only regret after 40 years is that I noticed that I'm still fighting and debating things that I was fighting for and debating 40 years ago. And I regret that this is the legacy that I'm leaving my children with. They're going to have to fight the same battles as I did from here on. But then again, I thought about that one day after saying it to an audience. This is the legacy I'm leaving, and I regret it. But I thought about it after walking out from that interview and said to myself, well, at least I may have taught them to stand up for their rights. And that's probably the legacy I'll leave to my children.
I really don't understand how to speed up the Canadian system around this stuff. Like, not that I'm saying executive orders have to be done like Trump did, like, you know, 70 to 90 different orders a day, but how, like, at least they sped up a system, a terrible system of going in a different direction. But I don't understand how Canada sort of speeds these things up and becomes more flexible.
You know, in the Canadian legal system, the only special interlocutor that exists in Canadian law is the one provided for in the Canadian Defence Act, National Defence Act. So there's no other position provided under law in Canada. So they're going to have to create it. That's why I spoke about the mandate and the terms of reference for this person that's going to be named to this position. And that's the important part. To what extent is the Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada able to create this position, and what are the limits of the mandate of this is the kind of stuff that will be is provided under the Department of Justice Act, which is pretty. He has a flexibility there, a bit of a flexibility. So again, they promised the C-15, the act on the UN Declaration back in 2015. They only managed to get it through just recently. So how soon is this going to come? I'm not sure. And unfortunately, for another two and a half years, I cannot lobby the federal government under the existing lobbying act, the federal lobbying act. So I'm not allowed to even talk to them. But I think the important thing to look for here is the when they're going to do it and the mandate in terms of reference of this person is going to be very important. That is where you will see if this will lead to criminal charges.
On that note, let's adjourn. That was the Backbench's first episode of 2022. We'll talk again in 2 weeks. And if you're following along what happens in Ottawa, let us know what you're watching closely, what you'd like to hear us discuss, what you're concerned about, what you want to understand better. Send us your questions, your concerns, your rants. Our email is backbench@candleland.com. We're also on Twitter @BackbenchCast. I'm Fatma Sayed, and you can find me on Twitter @FatmaBSayed. I want to make sure people can follow your work. So, Lena, tell everyone about the documentary you're working on and where people can find it.
Yeah, so the documentary I'm working on is for CBC Fifth Estate. It's going to be coming out in early 2022. And you can take a look for it on CBC. And thank you guys for having me. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Lena.
Riley, where are you?
Yeah, so I'm also on Twitter. I post my work there almost always after it's published. That's @RileyYesNoMaybe. I am also have a website where all my stuff is archived, and that's just RileyYesNo.com.
And Romeo, I know you're not retired, so where do people follow your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Romeo Saganesh in both cases. Been doing a lot of writing over the past year and a half now. So there should be interesting stuff coming out soon, I hope. Both in French and English, by the way.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Thank you so much. Seriously, I'm so grateful to you three. This episode was produced by Tiffany Lam with additional production by Tristan Capacchione. Our managing editor is Kieran Altshorn. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. Thank you for listening and see you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.